Good morning. The Education and Employment Committee will now come to order. Missy, please call the roll.
Chair Latvala.
Here.
Vice Chair McLean.
Here.
Committee Whip Andrade.
Here.
Ranking Member Williams.
Here.
Representative Alupas.
Here.
Representative Arrington.
Here.
Representative Bell.
Here.
Representative Barrero.
Here.
Representative Bush.
Here.
Representative Fine.
Here.
Representative Harding.
Here.
Representative Hawkins.
Here.
Representative Hanshofsky.
Here.
Representative Lamarca.
Here.
Representative Maney.
Here.
Representative Mariano.
Here.
Representative McCurdy.
Here.
Representative Morales.
Present.
Representative Trabulsi.
Here.
Representative Tuck.
Here.
Representative Valdez.
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Let the record show that a quorum is present. Please remember to silence all electronic devices. Be recognized by the chair before addressing the committee or the presenters. And remember to push the microphone button after you have been recognized, as a green light on your microphone no longer represents a live mic. Before we get started, Representative Mariano, you're recognized for a recognition.
Thank you, Chair. Everyone, just wanted to welcome my messenger that is here for the week, Lainey. Thank you so much for coming up. Please stand up so we can give you a round of applause. Thank you for your service to our state. We're so grateful to have you here.
I remember the good old days of being a messenger, Representative Mariano. That was back before you were born. Good morning, members. Today we have two bills on the agenda and a presentation on the implementation of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas School Safety Act and subsequent school safety measures that this legislature has passed. The first bill that we will be hearing is House Bill 225. Representative Hawkins, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair Latvala, Vice Chair McLean, Whip Andrade, Ranking Member Williams, members and staff, for the opportunity to present House Bill 225 dealing with charter schools. This bill really focuses on two areas of ambiguous language and sets standards and rules for how charters will be renewed, and also deals with the consolidation of charters. And Mr. Chairman, that is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hawkins. Members, are there any questions? Seeing none, are there amendments? There are none. Are there any public appearance cards? There are some of those. Tim Kilpatrick, Kids Community College, you are recognized. Thank you very much for being here, sir.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, committee. Thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to speak this morning. The bill that's before you today, as Representative Hawkins has alluded to, and thank you for sponsoring the bill, really sets to give clear direction to boards as it relates to not fulfilling the requirements of the existing law. There's a notification requirement in the existing law that says if a charter is not going to be renewed, there's an amount of time that's supposed to be given in order for us to be able to respond and react to such notification. It falls short by not establishing consequence if the board decides not to do that. Our experience last summer was that 2 weeks after the end of school, we were notified 15 days before our charter expired that they were not going to renew it, which sent about 2,000 families and another 600 employees wondering if they're going to have a school, a job, or giving us the opportunity to prepare for the upcoming school year. That was resolved only after getting the Commissioner of Education involved and reaching out to some of our representatives to help. But by that time, we're now 2 weeks before the start of school, and that's how we got to spend our summer after all things COVID-related. So thank you guys for considering this bill. Thank you once again for sponsoring, and thank you guys for the opportunity to speak today. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for being here. Next, we have Philip Suderman, Americans for Prosperity, who waves in support. Christian Camara, Florida Charter School Alliance, waves in support. Michael Woods, waves in opposition. Jacqueline Stevens, Local 1596, waves in opposition. Nora McGill, Local 517, waves in opposition. David Shrews, Foundation for Florida's Future, waves in support. Amanda Slushery, and I apologize if I botched that name. You're recognized. You are here. She is an opponent of the bill. Jennifer Showalter, Freedom Works. You're recognized. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for letting us speak. I'm Jen Showalter. I'm a mom in Palm Beach County. I am a mom of three. I have a senior, I have a sophomore, and I have a fifth grader. And just FYI, I had to pull my fifth grader out of school because he was being physically harassed by staff. My two sons are high-functioning autistics, sensory processing disorder, dysgraphia, Erlen syndrome, a whole host of special needs. They were denied their medical exemptions twice. From a school board, that was defying you. They were defying the state legislature, the state executive, and the state judicial. Just FYI. I am for HB 225, which helps lower regulations that hinder operations and provide additional modifications for charter schools. It's avenues like charter schools that are critical and need to be fostered. Personal note, when I pulled my son, I didn't even go for the Hope Scholarship because I knew other people probably needed it more than I did. I looked at, there were no charter schools available, and even private schools. They were either following the mask mandate, or they were full, or they couldn't handle his IEP. So I'm a big proponent for school choice. We need to be able to let the children go where they need to go and not try and force them into a box that doesn't fit. So these charter schools are just one example of why school choice is so important. So I just wanted to let you know about that and say, please protect the Constitution and our individual rights, because this is what it's about. It's about teaching kids in the way they need to be taught. And like I said, not all kids fit in the same box. So charter schools is just one way that they might be able to get a different direction in how they're taught. So thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Dr. Karen Hilty, Freedom Works. Hilt, waves in support. Karen Moran from Best, waves in support. Rada Colon from Freedom Works, waves in support. Margaret Susan Cottle from Best, waves in support. Angelique Contreras, Parents Know Best, waves in support. Ingrid Ford from Best, I believe, waves in support. Taurus Wolk from Freedom Works, waves in support. Members, we're in debate. Would anybody like to debate on this bill? All right, seeing none, Representative Hawkins, you are recognized to close on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be brief. This bill allows charter schools to be on the same plane as public schools. Most public schools are in the planning stages for next year right now. This gives the comfort for the charter schools to also start their planning for next year by knowing when they can be renewed and that process. This bill is really more about the teachers who are, we struggle right now to get teachers, giving them the comfort for those that want to work in charter schools to know that they'll have that job in the future, but also for our families and our children to know that the school of their choice will be there for them when their charter is approved in a timely manner. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I close.
Thank you, Representative Hawkins. Missy, please call the roll.
Representatives Alufis?
Yes.
Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
Yes.
Bell?
Yes.
Barrero?
Yes.
Bush?
Yes.
Fine?
Yes.
Harding?
Yes.
Hawkins?
Yes.
Hinchofsky?
Yes.
Lamarcus?
Yes.
Maney?
Yes.
Mariano?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
McCurdy?
Yes.
Morales?
Yes.
Trabulsi?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Valdez?
Absolutely yes.
Williams?
Yes.
Chair Latvala?
Yes. By your vote, CS for House Bill 225 will be reported favorably.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Next, we'll take up House Bill 1505 by Representative Trabulsi, background screenings. And you are recognized when you are ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair McLean, Whip Andrade, and Ranking Member Williams. I'm really excited to be here today to present 1505 background screening. As some of you may know, I started this journey looking at addressing background screening requiring for summer camps. As I learned more about this issue, it became clear that background screening in Florida was a network of disparate systems that housed multiple records of the same individuals, whether it was across school districts, in volunteer and civic organizations, or individuals dually employed. Think school district, and then think summer camp. However, after really studying this issue, I learned all records end up at FDLE. Since Florida participates in the Next Generation Identification, NGI, system, these fingerprint records are open and continually run against state and national arrest records, where alerts are sent to different entities throughout the state. Mr. Chair, I do have a strike-all amendment that was created with support of House Education staff.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Representative Trabulsi. Members, are there any questions on the underlining bill? There is an amendment, as was mentioned. Representative Trabulsi, you are recognized to explain Amendment 210695.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The problem with the current approach is that while entities get alerts, these records are not always portable across sectors such as education, school districts, child welfare agencies. Therefore, this bill looks to utilize Florida's award-winning background screening solution, the Agency for Healthcare Administration, ACA, Care Provider Background Screening Clearinghouse, or we can just call it a clearinghouse, as the statewide system for managing background screenings. This technology to date, based on a House Judiciary Committee presentation, has saved the state. It saved the taxpayers since implementation began in January 2013, over $5.5 million in screenings, and has collectively saved healthcare providers and licensees nearly $92 million by sharing screenings throughout the clearinghouse. Given that this system is undergoing modernization, this year is the time to embrace technology and create efficiencies by allowing education entities and organizations that participate in the Volunteer and Employment Criminal History System, VEX, to access this functionality and cost saving. This bill deletes out-of-date references for submission of electronic fingerprints. It also defines education units, which includes DOE, school districts, special district units, university schools, Florida School for the Deaf and Blind, Florida Virtual School Programs, charter schools, and our alternative schools, and grants them access to the clearinghouse. Educational units may also share results across educational units, so a school district to a charter school. This moves VEX participants into the clearinghouse as well as early learning coalitions. This requires athletic coaches to be level 2 background screened using the VEX authority to align to the National Child Protection Act. We're requiring FDLE to develop a method for establishing direct identification, such as facial recognition or retina scans. This does not allow for an exemption for staff volunteers for entities that provide care for children under State Statute 435.079 to keep children safe, which would be older children with disabilities. And finally, aligns the process for fingerprint submission for school personnel, contractors, and vendors to the process for using the clearinghouse. This bill has an implementation of July 1st, 2023 to allow the clearinghouse to finish modernization and train entities on how to use the system. And that is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for explaining the amendment. Are there questions on the amendment? Representative Fine, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative, I just have one question to make it very clear for everyone, because sometimes people will present bills that might make it easier. Say there's too many things you've got, too many hoops you have to jump through in order to be a volunteer at a school, something I don't agree with. So I want to be clear, this strike all will increase our ability to find bad people who want to volunteer in schools and help protect kids more, not loosen the standards. Am I understanding it correctly?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative Fine. Yes, you are stating that clearly, and also it will allow for portability, so it will be ease of use as well. So if you wanted to volunteer, let's say, for your child's after-school activity, and you also wanted to volunteer at Boys and Girls Club, you would not have to go through multiple screenings. They would all be in the same clearinghouse, meaning a database.
Thank you.
Representative Valdez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. In reference to, in lines 479 and 485, where it talks about the FDLE program, I'll read you the very last, it's a huge sentence, but after it says on line 482, it says, enrolled in the National Retained Print Arrest Notification Program at the Federal Bureau of Investigation when the Department of Law Enforcement begins participation in that program or in the program. What program are we talking about? What does that look like? Because I believe, based on what this says, that FDLE has not implemented a program.
Representative Trabolsi, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you mind if I call an expert to answer that question?
Sure.
Thank you.
Just make sure to fill out a parent's card. Oh, I'm sorry.
It is house staff.
Yeah, you're recognized.
So this is just language relating to the next generation system as it's being fully implemented by the FDLE. So it's just borrowing language from when the clearinghouse was implemented to make sure that we can use the same system that they're currently using for the people in the clearinghouse, for all the new people being added to the system.
Follow-up?
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. So it's not another program that's being implemented that hasn't been implemented yet?
You're right.
The FDLE is currently implementing this system. I don't know if it's fully implemented right now, but this language just makes sure that as it's being implemented and as they use that system, the clearinghouse will also use that system.
Thank you. One more question?
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
Thank you. Rep, I know how passionate you are, as we all are, about keeping our kids safe. I'm a little concerned about using biometrics, though. I mean, if that's where the state is heading, I'm really concerned about using biometrics and things of that nature. Do you have any concerns about that, or what's your feeling on the use of biometrics?
You're recognized.
Thank you for that question. I understand. Yesterday I was in a committee and they were talking about vertical mobility, and I felt like I was in the Jetsons. So I completely understand your question. But your biometric identification is just as effective as your fingerprints, if not more.
Gotcha.
Members, any other questions?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Ranking Member Williams, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Once you receive the fingerprints in the clearinghouse, are you able to use it at different locations, or every time that you go to somewhere else, you have to do the fingerprints over again?
You're recognized.
Thank you for that question, Representative. Absolutely, you are able to use that level two background screening through different areas.
Members, any other questions? All right, is there any public testimony on the amendment? There is. Michelle Watson, Florida Alliance of Children's Councils and Trusts, waves in support on the amendment. Members, is there debate on the amendment? All right, seeing none, Representative Tribolsi, you're recognized to close on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Valdez, you are correct. This is a very important and passionate subject matter for me, and I believe it is for all of us in the Florida House, as we want our children to be safe and protected. And by moving all of these entities into one clearinghouse that has already been proven to be extremely effective, it will not only create safety, it'll create efficiency, it'll create cost savings, and it will create a better workflow. So with that, I ask for your support, and I close.
Having closed on the amendment, all in favor of the adoption of the amendment say yay.
Yay. Yay.
All opposed, no. By your vote, the amendment is adopted. We are back on the bill as amended. Is there a debate on the bill as amended? Representative Fine, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank you for running this bill. So I have some experience with this, having become a volunteer. I'm a Boy Scout volunteer. I volunteer both my oldest son's government school and my youngest son's private school. And you've got to go through this process multiple times. But and so this will make it easier. But at the same time, I have seen people slip through the cracks who shouldn't have. So we had a situation, very high-profile situation, in Brevard County, where a former assistant coach and substitute teacher was arrested for having an inappropriate relationship with what was believed to be a student at the school. Parents didn't want to press charges, didn't want to drag their daughter's name through the mud, so things were dropped, and it never made it to a court of law. But that same person was then able, after having done that, to sort of get back into the school system to potentially groom new victims because as a volunteer. As if that wasn't bad enough, this person's an elected official in Brevard County. So I am grateful for what you're doing, because we did catch it, and we did get this guy out of the schools so that he couldn't continue to do it again. But clearly there is room for improvement, and we have no higher and important purpose in this job than protecting our kids. So thank you for taking this on. It's a complicated issue. It looks like you've done great work, and congratulations.
Members, sometimes when you've been here for a long time, you still have slip-ups. We're supposed to be in public testimony, and that's my fault. We do have two appearance cards on the main bill. So let's just pretend like we didn't hear Representative Fine debate. Yeah, we'll strike his words from the record, and we'll call him in a minute.
I'm happy to say it again in a few minutes. So.
In public testimony on the main bill, Barney Bishop from Florida Smart Justice Alliance waves in support on the main bill. Michelle Watson, Florida Alliance of Children's Councils and Trusts, waves in support on the main bill. Representative Fine, you're recognized in debate. Would you like to repeat
whatever I said before?
Hear, hear. Members, we're in debate. Would anybody like to debate? Whip Andrade, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Bolsey, thank you so much for bringing this bill, and thank you for taking my call to discuss it. I never really had any concerns about it, but background checks and some of the hoops that and hurdles that people have to jump through do become a major issue. I mean, I recall at the beginning of COVID, like we discussed, when our schools were shut down and teachers wanted to serve in our summer camp style programs to monitor these children who didn't have a place to go, the fact that they couldn't go and have their background checks portable was a huge concern. And I'm not 100% sure exactly if this would solve that specific problem, but I do know it will solve problems like it. And so I appreciate all the work you're putting into it and the work you're going to continue to do with it.
Members, is there anybody that would like to debate? All right, seeing none, Representative Tribolsi, you recognize the close on this very fine bill.
Thank you, Chair Latvala. Representative Fine, anytime in committee you want to multiply give compliments, I am all about it. I'm just happy I'm not being hazed, so thank you so much. It's not too late for Chair LaValla to do that, though. I just threw myself under the bus. Representative Andrade, yes, this is the first stop, and there is work still to be done. I would love to continue having conversations with you because I don't think we will ever, ever be done making more strides to make our children safe and also making the accessibility for good people to be able to volunteer, teach, and coach our children. And with that, I actually close on the bill.
Representative Grabowski, make no mistake, I knew this was your first bill in our committee. But I also recognize the substance of this bill. So your time will come, I assure you. thank you, Representative Trabolsi. Missy, please call the roll.
Representatives Alufis?
Yes.
Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
Yes.
Bell?
Yes.
Barrero?
Yes.
Bush?
Yes.
Fine?
Yes.
Harding?
Yes.
Hawkins?
Yes.
Hunchowski?
Yes.
Lamarca?
Yes.
Maney?
Yes.
Mariano?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
McCurdy?
Yes.
Morales?
Yes.
Grabowski?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Valdez?
Absolutely yes.
Williams?
Yes.
Chair LaValla?
Yes. Members, by your vote, House Bill 1505 will be reported favorably. Representative Trabolsi, we did note that your opening was incorrect, so we're going to need you to do that all over again.
Would you like me to, sir?
No, I'm just kidding. well done. Your bill passes. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Members, we're now in the presentation portion of our committee on the Office of Safe Schools. Chancellor Oliva, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair LaValla. Thank you, committee members, for allowing me to provide an update on some of the work that's happened with the implementation of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Act. We've done a lot of work when it comes to school safety, and I know there's a lot of work to do. And before we get into the presentation, I just want to remind everybody, I feel it's really important to remind everybody that we are recognize that we are soon coming up on the four-year anniversary of the horrific tragedy at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, which occurred on February 14th, 2018, where 17 students and educators lost their lives. And that foundation of that incident has led this legislature to take some immediate and swift action. And I'm here to provide an update on some of the initiatives of where we are and recognize that there's still some opportunities to improve what we're doing and make some significant improvements moving forward. You can see on this timeline that immediately after the tragedy in 2018, this legislature did take swift action with the passage of Senate Bill 7026. And each year after the passage in 2018, there were some key monumental bills that was passed through the legislature that are currently being implemented that identified some key objectives and strategies that we're supporting statewide. So what I'd like to do is just kind of do a quick overview through each year on some of these major initiatives and give you an update on where we are. In 2018, with 7026, there was historic safety and mental health funding allocated to Florida schools, and it also established a comprehensive model for improving the safety of Florida schools. This bill created the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission, who continues to meet and advocate for the safety and well-being of our students. I'd be remiss if I didn't recognize Sheriff Gualtieri, who chairs that commission, who does an outstanding job with the members of that commission in providing recommendations and reports to the department as well as to the legislature. It also created the Office of Safe Schools, which originally started with three employees, and that office has been prioritized by our agency and now includes 17 employees, seven of which are located regionally throughout the state so that they can provide ongoing professional development support and help provide monitoring for safety and compliance statewide. This bill also required that every district establish a school safety specialist and requires a safe school officer at every school, created the Coach Aaron Feist Guardian Program to help meet that requirement of a safe school officer at every school, and also outlines the pathways for the Guardian Program to be initiated. The legislation expanded mental health efforts and provided extensive funding for school safety improvements, including Fortify Florida, which is an anonymous tip and reporting tool that is currently still being utilized. This bill also expanded mental health efforts by establishing youth mental health awareness training for all school personnel. And that's where every school personnel, whether you're a teacher, a bus driver, food service employee, everybody that works in a district, receive a minimum amount of training in recognizing signs and symptoms in students that may need to be identified for additional layers of support. In 2019, with the passage of Senate Bill 7030, this built on some of the foundation that was laid in 2018, but also included some recommendations from the first report by the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission, which included strengthening the accountability, compliance, and oversight for the department to make sure that these initiatives that are outlined in the legislation are being fully implemented with fidelity. This also created the behavioral threat assessment model that allows teachers and staff to be proactive in enabling and identifying the possible warning signs in students and implement tiers of wraparound supports and assistance for these students as early as possible. In response to this bill, there was also rulemaking authority given to the department to establish some rules for more accurate data reporting and requirement. This revolved around a term referred to as SESR. SESR is the School Environmental Safety Incident and Reporting model. And what this rule does is provide us some more clear definitions for schools so that they can give us more accurate information, and then also require some monthly reporting components. In 2020, with Senate Bill 70, Governor DeSantis signed into law of that June, which is referred to as ELISA's law. The main requirement of this legislation was for all public schools to implement a mobile panic alert system. I'm happy to report that all districts currently have agreements in place with either a department vendor that's been identified through a procurement process or implementing a locally selected solution. The vendors are still currently working with county 911 coordinators to identify the most effective methods for integration. With the statewide panic alarm system is the first of its kind. We know that it's already been proven to save lives. I'd like to share a quick story about a student at Dunbar High School in Southwest Florida. There was a 17-year-old student who went into cardiac arrest during class. Her teacher thought quickly and did not hesitate to hit the newly installed ELISA alert panic button, which prompted the immediate response of staff and health professionals who were able to use an AED system and save that student's life. She's making a full recovery, and her families and teachers credit the fact that the ELISA's alert and the quick action of the incredible staff members was able to save her life. In 2021, with the passage of Senate Bill 590, it continued to strengthen oversight and compliance on school safety and helped align resources to better address student mental health issues. This bill requires the district to report the number of involuntary examinations, also referred to as Baker Acts, initiated at schools or school activities. The department is currently in the process of building a database to collect this information. And once it's in place, we're working with school district context on identifying the type of data that will be required so that we can start building out that comprehensive annual report. This bill also required schools to notify a parent or guardian prior to a Baker Act of a student, and further requires that parents receive timely notifications of threats, unlawful acts, and significant emergencies that may happen on a school campus. Districts are also required to add crisis and suicide hotline information to the school student ID badges. The Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission is still moving forward and making recommendations. In 2019, there was a second report issued, and there's still some key components identified that we're working with the commission and the legislature for possible adoption implementation. Some of this requires work around reunification plans, looking at the emergency drill requirements, and then requiring for the threat assessment team members to be involved, all of those members to be involved throughout the entire threat assessment process. Senate Bill 7030 also outlined another key component to bridging the gap between mental health and school safety, collecting school safety data. The department was tasked with creating a centralized integrated data repository and data and analytics resource tool to provide timely access to school safety information. This Florida school safety portal is fulfilling this requirement. The tool became accessible to school districts in 2019. This slide shows how this tool would be kind of the database hub that meets some of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission's recommendation to make sure that we can improve timely, complete, and accurate information by authorizing the school threat assessment teams to swiftly identify, assess, and provide interventions for individuals whose behavior may pose a threat to themselves or others. There is significant confidentiality requirements and sensitive data that is integrated into this portal. We're continuing to work with school districts on how they can establish local protocols to meet the confidentiality requirements while getting staff trained. We are planning on doing an Office of Safe Schools summer training this summer, where we're going to be working with all of the school districts on giving them updates how they can better utilize this tool, and we expect that once this training occurs, an uptick in usage will continue. Senate Bill 7030 also tasked the department to convene a work group that identifies and prioritizes best practices for school safety and security. This slide outlines some of the initiatives that have been identified that schools should be utilizing when establishing local protocols and implementing best practices. To support the initiation of many of the strategies that are identified on this slide, the legislation approved a school hardening grant, and school districts received a certain amount of funding based on a formula that they can request dollars from the department to implement the strategies that were identified by the work group and use these dollars to put some school hardening techniques put into place. Most of these projects can be capital in nature, but they also must be physically attached to the districts or buildings and be properly fixed with all capital outlay rules. And it also must be associated with improving the physical security of school buildings and campuses. And then when schools are identifying where they want to prioritize their funding, those priorities need to be identified in their Florida School Safety Assessment Tool. So we're continuing to work with districts and allocating these funds so that they can make those capital improvements to initiate and support those strategies. To support the behavioral threat assessment team, the department surveyed every single school district to find out how they were doing and where they were and who was being involved. And the Comprehensive School Threat Assessment Guideline implementation is a tool that we are working with districts to support the implementation of the threat assessment teams in reviewing the data. We've been able to reach from the schools that all teams include a sworn law enforcement officer and a mental health professional when they're implementing those teams. And we've also been able to partner in supporting districts with active training in threat assessments and expand our base of qualified instructors through a train-the-trainer model. So with the implementation of the Comprehensive School Threat Assessment Guide, we've been working with every school district at the state level to make sure that they have trained folks in their districts that can do on-site training at each and every school level. The department also supports this initiative by providing technical assistance through different webinars. It's really about building a foundation of behavioral care assessment, and we know that each district and each student has their own unique needs, and we're helping to support districts with the implementation of this program. We get a lot of questions about which school districts are implementing the option of establishing the Coach Aaron Feist Guardian program. So we created this map for you to see which districts are utilizing it. You can see that the blue districts are the 43 districts that are currently utilizing the Guardian program. So that list seems to keep expanding as districts are moving forward with their implementation of safety plans. When we're talking about improving school safety, another key component about that is supporting mental health services. So this slide in the next slide, I'm going to go into a little bit about some of the initiatives around supporting the school mental health assistance allocation. I'd also like to thank First Lady Casey DeSantis for her leadership in bringing mental health awareness to the forefront and prioritizing many statewide initiatives that impact our students. She's been a great advocate in promoting mental health education, as well as establishing a HOPE Ambassadors program and making sure that all of the state agencies are being efficient in supporting these initiatives together as well in a collaborative manner. Districts are using the mental health assistance allocation funding to train school staff on youth mental health first aid, as well as expanding the capacity to broaden school-based mental health providers right there at the school level. Reducing ratios was something that was identified as a priority for access for students to have the ability to see a school counselor, a school psychologist, or a school social worker. The department also meets with DCF, the Division of Children and Families, and local managing entities for that support behavioral health and make sure that there's a coordination of care that's being established across the public schools or the school sector and then the private providers. You can see that there's been some historic investments in mental health, supporting mental health initiatives. There's about $5.5 million in recurring state funds that are appropriated to support that youth mental health awareness and first aid training for teachers and all school personnel. There was $8.9 million in recurring funds through a federal preschool development infant and early childhood mental health grant, which allows for subgrants throughout the state to support their certified professionals and give them the knowledge and skills in supporting infant and early childhood mental health initiatives. $2 million was set aside from our federal CARES funding that was directed to reduce mental health professional to student ratios and increase mental health services in rural districts throughout the pandemic. And then if you see on the bottom, it's important, I think, to highlight that there has been a significant investment in supporting mental health. You can see in 2017 and 18, there wasn't any funds allocated specifically to support this initiative. And you can see throughout the years, it went from originally about a $69 million allocation to last year about $120 million. When we work with districts on supporting mental health initiatives, we provide in-person and virtual technical assistance for professional development to districts. The department does receive and review every district's mental health assistant allocation plan to make sure that it's in compliance with Florida statute. We do review, collect, analyze data in supporting achievement of district-determined mental health goals. And then we're in the early phases of developing out those data collection systems so that we can collect data and provide more accurate information. With that, Chair, I think it's important to just kind of recap that this has been a major investment in the state of Florida and making sure that we're coordinating our system of care and providing tier levels of supports and keeping safety at the forefront and priority for our students when they're in our care. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Chancellor Leva. And one of the most important things that we can do is make sure that students are safe while they're at school. And as you mentioned, the anniversary is coming up on February 14th, and you know, it was the saddest day in recent Florida history, and it was the most preventable mass shooting in American history, I believe. And, you know, it's our job to make sure that it never happens again in Florida, and that 17 more families never have to go through what the 17 families in Broward County and in Representative Hemchowski's district have had to go through the last 4 years since that dreadful day. And so I have a couple questions, and I'm sure some of y'all have some questions as well. But a couple weeks after the shooting in 2018, as you mentioned, the legislature passed Senate Bill 7026. The following year, we passed Senate Bill 7030. So 4 years ago and then 3 years ago. Since that time, are there school districts that have still not complied with aspects of those two bills?
So one of the roles that Myers-Stoneman Douglas Commission has been engaged in is surveying districts for implementation of Florida statute in compliance. To my knowledge, with those many different components right now, what's required in law, all school districts are implementing what's required in law with fidelity at this time.
Has it taken some districts until very recently to comply?
So one of the objectives of the Office of Safe Schools is to ensure oversight and compliance, and there are some districts that do need reminders for meeting deadlines and coming into compliance, but with their support and the relationships that we're building with districts and reiterating that sense of urgency, we're able to get them where they need to be.
Okay. On the Senate Bill 7030, how do we know if schools and districts are using CESAR?
So when it comes to CESAR data, that's one of those areas that we have an opportunity to improve. And the department is able to collect data and look at patterns of what's being reported from districts. So every district has reported CESAR incidents. Until recently, there wasn't a very clear definition on how to code certain incidences that would trigger that CESAR warning. The CESAR incidences are identified for things that have happened on campus that would require state notification. There was definitely a belief that there was underreporting happening. And through the recent state board rule, we were able to provide clear definitions, and now we get that data from school districts monthly so that we can make sure that they're reporting accurate data as swiftly as possible as well. That started this past school year.
On Alyssa's law, Senate Bill 70, which was passed in 2020, you mentioned that all districts have agreements. It's my understanding that not all districts are currently using the system, though. When can we expect all districts to be using the system?
So the department procured or put out an intent for different vendors to be able to be on a list that districts could choose which vendor meets their needs locally and purchase the system that integrates best with what they have. Some districts already had a locally established system, so they had the flexibility to either use one of the vendors that have been identified from our agency or continue to support their locally initiated plan that was put in place. Every district has an agreement with or a contract with one of our vendors or has that local contract to be implemented. Those plans are being implemented and integrated now. There are some districts that are still working with their local 911 coordinators so that when somebody hits the button, it gets put to the right place. So there's some technical components and aspects of it. I would say pretty confidently by the end of the school year, those systems should be all up and running. There is a transition for implementation time. But districts are acting with urgency and meeting this requirement. But there is some districts, there's still some technical aspects that are being ironed out.
Okay. Members, I don't want to monopolize all of the questions. Representative Valdez, recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair LaValle. And thank you so much, Chancellor Oliva, for the update on the security plan. Is there a mechanism for individual school principals to maybe apply for a specific mini grant to be able to enhance something in their school for school safety? For instance, the addition of cameras in their complex or things of that nature. Is there a mechanism for principals to be able to do that?
You're recognized.
So thank you for that question. I would say the principal needs to work with their district because we have the school hardening grants that the districts work with. I don't think a principal can apply straight to the state for a grant because those grants are allocated by district. But there is a path for principals to work with their district safety personnel to identify needs such as cameras or other opportunities, a single point of entry, fencing. Those are some of the bigger highlighted items that schools are investing in. So there is some dollars allocated to support that, but that principal really needs to work with their school district.
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized for follow-up.
Thank you, and I appreciate that, and that's the way it should work. And sometimes it's not always the way it works. So it could potentially be that some areas might get overlooked. And it, anyways, I was just hoping that there could be a possibility that in an extreme type of case that maybe principals would be able to have an opportunity to apply for a mini grant of some sort, because it's challenging at times. And so I was just hoping that maybe that might be something to look into in the near future. The other thing I wanted to mention was I'll never forget my freshman year. I didn't know that we were not allowed to have props. And my district had already implemented a little, Chair LaVada, you probably remember that meeting.
I remember it well, your necklace.
In my necklace, I had the lanyard with the little device. And unfortunately, it was low on battery, so it was like beeping, beeping, beeping. It was like, oh my gosh, Sarge had to come and take the lanyard. So just because it was disrupting kind of sort of the meeting. But it was a point of reference just to say that, you know, that tool could be very useful. So I was very grateful to see that I think it was Gottlieb that brought in the bill to be able to ensure that a device like that is included in all of the that districts had access to it. And I imagine that potentially probably some of our technological systems may not have been upgraded to be able to support a system like this. Do you think that that's probably why some of the districts have not been able to fully comply with it, that there could be some infrastructure needs? And if that's the case, how are we helping the districts? Is that through that hardening grant to be able to do that? How do we assist districts with their technological difficulties?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So I think when we're looking at providing assistance for districts, there's a wide range of opportunities, and there's different pots of money that have been allocated to support the initiatives that you're speaking about, whether it's technological in nature, whether it's capital in nature, or whether it's general operating in nature. It's really about the districts looking at prioritizing what's their best needs. And then, you know, even as I was thinking about that school principal that's saying, hey, I need some additional eyes and layers of supports, every district is using the FASAT, the Florida Safe Schools Assessment Tool, and that principal can identify in that tool that that district should be using to gather those reports and making those priorities. Is a platform for that voice to be heard. So when it comes to implementing the strategies that have been identified by the hardening and mitigating work groups, there's a robust set of best practices put in place. Districts are going to have to prioritize probably in different phases. What is a phase one that we're going to make sure every school has? What is a phase two and then and a phase three? Because it would be great to just wave a magic wand and then all of the schools have fencing and cameras and everything, but there is a transition time, and that's where we support schools and helping them prioritize and implement that transition.
Thank you for your hard work. I appreciate it.
Ranking Member Williams, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to say thank you for coming in and giving us that presentation and update. I remember the incident where we all were at that particular time. And I can actually say that I saw how everyone actually came together for the good of our children. It was a tragic incident, and we all felt the impact. Out of all the things that was actually put into place to try to protect our children, do we have any services or wraparound programs that has not been implemented at this particular time? I don't know if Chair LaVala will actually remember some of the things that we actually impact to 70-30 to make sure that our children are safe. Isn't it any additional things that we need to, as legislator, start wrapping our head around to make sure that all our kids will not, and parents will not have to go through that type of tragic incident that happened back in February 2018.
You're recognized.
So thank you for that excellent question. When I think of opportunities to continue to improve, what comes to mind is actually several different things, and it's really about not new initiatives, but continuing to build on the foundation that has been laid through some of this great legislation and perhaps maybe some of the allocations that have already been identified. But I can tell you when our Safe Schools teams and our student services teams are working in school districts, I think there's an opportunity to make sure that there's collaboration between all of the stakeholders, implementing that behavioral threat assessment team and identifying that coordinated system of care. When you look at those tiered supports for students, making sure that every student has access to an adult that cares about them is something that's always going to be ongoing and work to be done. But there's some work that needs to be done between the school's role when students are identified for needing more supports and the community partnership role, working with managing entities to make sure that we're efficient in the level of services that are being provided. There's opportunities there. I think we can get better. There's been some task force created to address that. And then I think when you talk about supporting mental health as a whole, access to school licensed mental health professionals and reducing those ratios has been consistently identified throughout our schools as something that there is value in that investment. And that's when we look at that mental health allocation, it's really about reducing numbers so that schools, if they want to see, students want to see their school counselor, they can get into that school counselor and see them, or a school psychologist, school social worker, and that pathway of access to mental health services and then supporting mental health education is something that I know as our agencies working with districts, we continue to build out additional resources and tools with high quality lessons for teachers to use so students understand how to assess their own mental health and then access to mental health services as well.
You have a follow-up? Representative Hawkins, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chancellor, good to see you again. Thank you for the presentation. I want to talk a little bit about the drills that are done. Do we find there's uniformity amongst the districts that they're all doing the same types of drills?
You're recognized.
So there are some requirements outlined in statute with the amount of fire drills, active assailant drills that schools have to do, and some of it's required to do monthly. There are some best practices that have been identified on how to do those drills better, but the best practices we share and work with districts on how to do them better may not be required by law, so there is some differentiated implementation of how those drills look. And realistically, those drills may need to look a little bit different, which you would expect to happen in a kindergarten classroom, maybe different than an 11th grade classroom, so there should be some flexibility in that. But I think we've definitely heard from districts and even from recommendations of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas Commission addressing the amount of drills, the type of drills, and clarity around what should happen during a drill, there's an opportunity to improve.
Yes, sir, you're recognized.
A follow-up on that. When speaking with the sheriff and the families, the reunification is a big process. And I know in my district, I happened to be at the school when a lockdown happened, but there was no follow-through on the reunification. Do we see where we will start adding that to make sure that we are practicing where the children should go, how reunification should happen? Is that something that you would see being part of those best practices?
Absolutely. When we work with districts to implement and recommend best practices, those are recommendations that we make to school districts. They may not be required, but if we recommend it, we feel like it's a practice of value. We definitely heard, especially with the Parkland parents in testimonies that I've been a part of with Marjory Stoneman Douglas Commission, with that incident, reunification was a huge issue. And every school, every district needs to have a specialized reunification plan established, and all the stakeholders need to know their role in reunification plans. That may be another opportunity, I think, that moving forward for possible recommendations around unification plans would be a conversation of value.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Morales, you recognize?
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for your presentation. This has been a very educational opportunity for me to learn about this. I want to explain to learn more about the mental health aspect of this program that you have, the mental health assistance allocation funding. Trying to see how I can put it together. Do you have data to show how these implementations have taken place? Like, is there a possibility that I can review it or look at it with your permission? Would that be available to review?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Excellent question. So each year the department receives a plan from each school district on how they're going to use their school-based mental health allocation dollars. So in those plans, it might identify professional development, it might identify curriculum, it might identify personnel that they want to hire and add to their teams. The department collects all those plans. We review them and we post them on our website. So we'd be happy to, I don't know if last school year's plans are on there, so I have to check on that off the top of my head. But we can provide access to those plans. And then additionally, I think if I was to highlight one of the commonalities of which most districts are using that funding for, is really to reduce ratios for numbers to students. So we can provide an update. I'm not sure when the recent survey was done, but I know we have some data that shows how those numbers have reduced historically over time, and we'd be happy, Chair, to share that with the committee.
You have a follow-up?
No, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, and please get that information.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Hanchowski, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Latvala. And before I ask my questions, I was mayor at the time. Many of these families were my friends even prior to this. And one would think a tragedy like this would bring everyone together. But if we go back and look at the actual history, it was a very close vote, and the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Act almost did not pass back in 2018. And I would once again like to thank all of those who had political courage. It was a very toxic, traumatic, and difficult time, and it took a lot of political courage for people to find a middle way on a bill that no one thought was the best we could have done. It was a compromise. And in that spirit, Chair Latvala, I just want to thank you for your purposeful, compassionate, and unrelentless leadership on this issue. You took this as your issue. You have led on school safety from day one. Never wavered, met with everybody. We had students who came up at the time who were obviously incredibly traumatized and very upset about how the process went. And Chair Latvala sat with them and let them air their grievances, no matter how hurtful some of the words may have been. And I just like people to remember that, because as time goes by, we forget how personal this is. We forget about the thousands of students who had to walk over dead bodies to get out of the school that day and the trauma they carry with them. And I talk about this very openly because sometimes when we talk about policy, we forget the people affected by it. All policy is personal. And so I just want to thank, since I've been here elected in this position, and even prior when I was mayor, there's been such support for this, and I want to thank all the colleagues that I serve with today who have pushed for school safety, who have pushed for our student safety, and we can't forget our teacher safety, our administrator safety, our staff safety, everybody who's there. And I just appreciate working with all of you on these issues, on mental health issues, and I just want to say thank you, because I think sometimes in this process we forget that we're all humans along the way. So I just want to thank you for your indulgence, Chair, on that. I want to start with that. I hope I'm not going to get in trouble from you for complimenting you.
Members, I love each and every one of you like my children. Some days I like Representative Petrosky a little bit more. But the other day, we did have a meeting in my office, and, part of leaving here is you start cleaning out your office. And I had a business card from the mayor of Parkland, Christine Hinchowski, still in my drawer. And so I was going to wait to give it to her, you know, at the right time. And she actually was meeting with me on school safety, so I figured that would be the appropriate time. And so when she was in my office, I slid it across the desk and told her, you know, to keep it. And it does bring back, you know, memories. And I remember, like, yesterday meeting with those students, and it was not Representative Petrosky that was with them. It was Representative Jacobs who escorted them around. And she was very instrumental in passing that bill and getting a lot of bipartisan support for that very good measure. But the work that you did, not only as mayor, as a representative, is very, and you know, you're just getting started. You still have a long way to go. This is a very important issue, and it's one that, you know, we're just kind of getting started with. Enough about that. You're recognized to ask a question.
Thank you very much, Chair. Speaking about the mental health situation, I know there was money set aside for more staff, but in many of our schools, because of the lack of staffing, our guidance counselors and psychologists are reduced to testing. I know testing is going to be an issue this session. What are we doing to make sure that we actually don't just have the bodies in the schools, but we also have them doing the job that they are trained to do and the professional job that they have in making sure that our students are getting the care and those support services that they need? So I guess what I'm asking is, are we making sure that we have really enough school psychologists doing school psychology work and not, you know, doing testing?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So when it comes to those job descriptions and personnel decisions, those are done at the local level. But I can tell you, in our support working with districts, those are very real conversations that we have. It's not a good investment to hire a school psychologist and put them on lunch duty every day. But then sometimes a school counselor or a school psychologist would be like, that's the best chance that I get to connect with students each and every single day. So sometimes those assignments could turn into positives, but those are really meant at the local level. Making a school counselor a testing coordinator is a reality that happens often. And if there's ways to alleviate that, we would support that as well, because it's not a good use of their professionalism or their qualifications. So we constantly have conversations with districts on how to better utilize their staff.
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. So I would submit that funding is an issue. I know there's a bill currently, Representative Placencia has it, regarding salaries. I think they are relegated to doing other things because they're short-staffed. Are there things that you can help advocate for to get more funding into those? I think we've all seen it with COVID, that it's really brought some of these issues to the forefront. We do need more mental health support in our schools. What are there some things that you're looking at or working on, and how we can not just have a program, but also have the full funding behind that program for those early investments?
You're recognized.
So I think that's part of the spirit of today's conversation, and is advocating for full funding of some of these initiatives. The reality, when you talk about recruiting talent to go in this profession, is we need to encourage more people to major in these degrees to become school counselors, school psychologists, school social workers. Because I do hear from districts that finding people to fill these jobs is a challenge. And there are, what we have definitely learned with working with districts is there's some deserts in the state of Florida where access to a licensed school psychologist may not be within 100 miles. And we've been very fortunate with the support of legislature with some investments in telehealth and creating innovative approaches to making sure students have access to mental health support. So I think you're right about supporting that investment. It needs to continue to grow and build, but then there's still opportunities to work with managing entities and the resources that they have available to them so that we're not creating two different systems, that we're creating one system efficiently as well.
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And I appreciate you bringing up that managing entities. That was something that was in last year's, what ended up being a school safety bill. Because also we experience that when students are being helped with behavioral health services in the school, when they're out for the summer, they often get handed off to someone else. So having the managing entities and having the community partners coming in and helping is a great help. One of the questions I wanted to ask was, we're having people falling through the cracks because sometimes there's this lack of communication, even within a school system, especially a larger one, where it might be more difficult. There was an idea brought forward of having a person at the district level as a mental health coordinator, and this would be a person to make sure that when the threat assessments are done and when students are recommended for certain wraparound services, to make sure that those are getting done. Have you looked into that at all, the idea of having someone at the district level who's kind of to make sure that no one falls through the cracks on those issues?
You're recognized.
So thank you for that question. I think if we were to ask school districts, do they have somebody that's tasked with doing that job, they would say, yes, we have people that are responsible for student services. I think the question that you're posed, is there value of having somebody dedicated solely for that one purpose? And if you look at some of our early legislation around school safety, it required each district to identify a school safety specialist. Well, somebody was in charge of school safety before that requirement, but that person may have also been in charge of 7,000 different other things. So is there value in saying that each district should have a dedicated professional that solely is responsible for that? I think it's an opportunity or a conversation worth having. I would mirror it similar to the requirement of a school safety specialist that's focused just on school safety. Thank
you. Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And then reunification is something that came up in Representative Hawkins' bill. I think he's doing a wonderful job in really identifying that. As someone who was there at the Marriott Hotel while the family members were waiting hours upon hours, the shooting occurred at 2:21 and 11:30 and midnight. Family members still had not gotten word, although they kind of knew because they were the ones left in that room. It's really important in that reunification process to identify, as you had mentioned, whose role is it to have, and I don't know what it is on technology, is it to have the computer with them to make sure that they have the records of that day of where everybody was. What are your thoughts on how districts could identify, or are you making recommendations to districts as to how they can identify whose role, who would be the best to serve that role to make that reunification process a more seamless process?
So thank you, excellent question. Our Office of Safe Schools and our folks that are in the regions can have a seat at that table of, okay, have you thought about if there was an incident here or somebody calls in a bomb threat and you have to move people over there, or where would be the best place to take people, and then who's responsible for making sure that we have current rosters and we can have contact information? And there's so many intricate pieces to develop a reunification plan. Offhand, I don't know if we've established best practices in development of a reunification plan or established a model reunification plan. I think that is something that we could definitely take back to our team and start having those conversations, because I think you've identified an opportunity to help support districts, because we don't want them floundering. And if there are some best practices or tools or resources that we could provide for them, then I think there's value in that investment.
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
And Chair, I'm going to ask for just to make a statement.
That's yes, okay. Ma'am.
Thank you. When this happened, I promised all the families that I would never forget. And as time goes by, people tend to forget. We have the fourth commemoration coming up on February 14th. So I would like to take the opportunity to remember the 17 and say their names so that we may always remember the purpose behind the work we do. Alyssa Aladef, Martin Duquet, Scott Beagle, Nicholas Dworet, Aaron Feiss, Jamie Guttenberg, Chris Hickson, Luke Hoyer, Kara Lochran, Gina Montalto, Joaquin Oliver, Elena Petty, Meadow Pollock, Helena Ramsey, Alex Schachter, Carmen Shentrup, and Peter Wang. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Trabulsi, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chancellor. I'm a little taken back right now, so I apologize. Thank you, Representative Honchowski, for being a champion. My question to you is around drills. And I remember as a child having fire drills and tornado drills. And, you know, after a while, we all knew that they were drills. So I guess my first question is, how is there a method in which we have different types of drills so that it doesn't become rote behavior? But more importantly, I was also that anxious kid that when a drill happened, it really scared me and I just wanted my mom. And I'm wondering if through those drills, our teachers or other support staff are recognizing students that may need some mental health services after a drill because they don't realize it's just a drill.
You're recognized.
So great question. When it comes to drills, we have fire drills, we have active assailant drills, we have severe weather drills. There's all kinds of drills that are happening in our schools. And there probably should be differentiated, I think, by different grade levels. Part of the conversations that I hear people talking about is if you count the number of drills that you start in kindergarten, by the time you're in 12th grade, it's like hundreds of the same drill. Do you really need to do the same thing over and over again? There's value in having those conversations. Supporting students with special needs during drills is a challenge for some school districts, especially if loud noises or sirens can set off some behaviors, have some unintentional consequences. But I hope that teachers are able to have conversations with students, especially as they're going through those drills, to make sure that the students understand the value of why they're doing those drills. Because the reality is when a school or a student is place in that predicament, they do know what to do. So we need to have drills. We need to implement them with fidelity. Is there an opportunity to look at the number of drills and maybe look at incorporating some best practices so that there are differentiated and it looks different? I think there's value in that as well.
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. It just brings me to a memory of my daughter who is a first grade school teacher, and they, you know, obviously do active shooter drills as well. And last year she told me of a drill when they all had to pile into her whole first grade class, had to, you know, pile into a concrete restroom in the hallway. And there were kids just petrified. Mm-hmm. And one teacher, you know, trying to calm those kids down. And the drills are so important. I'm not negating drills. I'm not even saying we should have less drills. But what I'm saying is those children, I don't know if one teacher can comfort those children and after a drill. And are there certain children that you might identify that really need some individualized services after that drill?
You recognize it.
I agree. And I think that's why teachers are so valuable, because they know their students. And when you get into those drill moments, that they're able to have those pre-conversations and post-conversations, but also identify students that are in distress. And even part of the training that we talked about today, their required training in youth mental health first aid, is really helping give those teachers the tools to recognize signs and symptoms of students that are in distress and then know what to do. So you can never underestimate the value of a teacher that has relationships with their students, because they will recognize that and then take the appropriate steps.
Members, any other questions? Representative Valdez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair Latvala. And Chancellor, to follow up in Representative Honchowski's question on fully funding, what would that number be to fully fund school safety throughout the state of Florida?
You're recognized.
$10 trillion? No, I'm just. That's a good question. I think if you are looking at the landscape, every district is in a different place. And when you're talking about implementing practices around school safety, I don't think you ever arrive. It's constantly evolving. Campuses are changing. The types of learners you're supporting are different. There is no finite amount of money. It's every year and throughout the year you're analyzing and prioritizing. And I don't think you're ever going to arrive. I don't think we're ever going to hit a check mark and say, we're all safe now, we don't need to start having this conversation. But it's about creating those tiers of support on what do we need to do now, what do we like to do, and where are we going to be in the future, and then setting those priorities. And then that could help you determine at a district level where you want to take the resources that you have.
Representative Valdez, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. So understanding that this is something that's going to be ongoing, and rightfully so, the current funding, I mean, we have Chair Fine. Well, anyways, he's listening, I'm sure. But having, you know, being the chair of the appropriations and also being on the appropriations subcommittee, I think it's important for us to know if our mark that we have now, is it sufficient on a yearly basis to continue to support, or do we need to increase those fundings allocations on a yearly basis, or if that current allocation, if we continue to, for it to be recurring, is it enough?
You're recognized.
I think if we were to ask school districts, they would say they're grateful for the funding they receive, but they would always advocate for additional resources as well.
Members, any other questions? On the Florida School Safety Portal data sources, which was page 8 on the slide, are all school districts required to use the portal? That's my first question on that slide.
So I may defer to my colleague Tim Hay, but offhand, I don't think they're required to use it. Yeah, he's okay. Correcting me on that.
Do you know how many districts are in compliance, or how many districts are using it?
That's something that we'd have to pull. It's a fairly new database, and we're still working it out and building out the training. To give a fair assessment, I think it's underutilized right now. And we have that marked as something that we want to prioritize our training on this summer, because there is value in getting these systems coordinated. It's just getting the systems coordinated and then training the right people on how to use those systems. There is definitely work to be done.
Okay. On the very next slide, on school hardening and harm mitigation work group, do we have a summary of every district's progress on implementing these best practices?
I don't know.
That's something y'all keep track of.
Yes, I don't know if we keep track of a summary on implementing these. These aren't a checklist of requirements. These are would have been identified as best practices in their recommendations. None of this is required in law. Districts embrace or prioritize the best practices that work best for them. If I was to kind of put an asterisk, are the ones that are probably the most utilized, that single point of entry I think has definitely been a priority for districts, making sure that there's one way in and one way out for campus, because that also leads to visitor management systems and making sure those best practices being implemented. Also radios, I think, and access to radios and law enforcement is probably been an identified area that I see most people prioritizing as well.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for being here, and thank you, Mr. Hay, for what y'all do. It's not my job. Those words were uttered by teachers in a large school district in South Florida when asked to identify hardened corners in their classrooms at the direction by the legislature and at the request of their school districts. In the event, heaven forbid, of another mass shooting. And not just one teacher said that, but a lot of them. And I won't identify that district, but you can probably figure out which one it is. It's not my job was the defense of the school resource officer when he literally hid behind a tree for 48 minutes on February 14th, 2018, while he could hear gunshots in the building at Marjory Stoneman Douglas, while 17 people were being murdered. And he used that as a defense in court. It's not my job was a defense that a teacher at Marjory Stoneman Douglas used when a beautiful freshman young lady was taking a test outside of the outside of her class on that fateful day, and when the shooting started, the teacher locked the door. That young lady ultimately was gunned down, and the teacher said it was not her job. That's why we do a school safety bill every year. And that's why I imagine that Representative Hawkins, Representative Humchowski, and others that are freshmen will make sure that this is something that we will continue to do. Because there's always going to be little things that we can do to make sure that what happened 4 years ago will never happen again in the state of Florida. Representative Trabalsi moves that we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.